we read, "When the enemy were in the east, then the army was kept in the west. And when they were in the south, then our army was in the north." Clearly, no one really knows what's going on. So the king tried getting some good advice. The chronicle goes on to say, "Then all the counselors were ordered to the king, and it had then to be decided how this country should be defended. But whatever was then decided, it did not stand for even 1 month." And I think this is the sort of thing that gets the king nicknamed Bad Counsel. He can't settle on a coherent policy and stick with it. Now, King Ethelred does make one decision that is going to have huge implications for English history down the road. And whether they're good or bad is something I'll leave open. The king is concerned about the Vikings getting support from Normandy. Normandy is, of course, right across the English Channel in France, and it's territory that had been settled by Vikings early in the 10th century. Their leader, Rollo, had accepted baptism from the French king in exchange for lands in western France, and that becomes Normandy, and it's named Normandy after the Northmen who settled there. Now, by the late 10th century, the Normans have pretty much settled down and become Frenchmen. They're not speaking Old Norse anymore. They're speaking French. But they still have ties to Scandinavia. And they were sometimes letting Viking fleets refit on their coast. So Ethelred decided on a diplomatic maneuver to try to short-circuit this connection. He decides to marry the Duke's sister, Emma. And the marriage takes place in 1002. Now, by this point, the king has been on the throne for 24 years. He has children from an earlier marriage already. Emma was quite young when she came to England, but she did bear the king three children, two sons, Edward and Alfred, and a daughter, Godgifu. The relationship doesn't really end up helping England against the Vikings very much, but it's successful in one sense. Normandy is available for King Ethelred to flee to, when he ultimately loses his kingdom. Duke Richard of Normandy does end up taking in his hapless brother-in-law, who was kicked off the throne. The importance of the marriage in the long run, though, is that Emma of Normandy ends up having a great-nephew named William, Duke of Normandy. We'll get to him in the next lecture. For now, though, let's go back to England's Viking problem in the early 11th century. Throughout the 990s and the first decade of the new millennium, England had been facing the threat from Swain Forkbeard of Denmark. Sometimes Swain raided, sometimes he accepted Danegeld, but he never just went away. And in 1009, he makes a huge effort at final conquest in England. He doesn't quite pull it off. He accepts one final Danegeld payment 3 years later in 1012, but in 1013, he comes back with a bigger, stronger army, and this time he succeeds. Ethelred's supporters had never been a very unified bunch. There had been factional splits since the start of his reign. They'd never really gotten any better. And once Swain arrived in 1013, many of the English king's followers began to defect to Swain. They saw brighter prospects ahead under the Danes. And the Danish card paid off. The area of Danish settlement in eastern England backed Swain wholeheartedly. The King of England is forced to flee. He takes refuge in Normandy with his wife's relatives. And most English people accept Swain as their king. But the story's not over yet. There are going to be several more twists and turns. In 1014, Swain Forkbeard dies. He's been King of England for just a year. He leaves behind a son, Knut, who was very young at the time, only in his teens. And at that point, the English magnates decide to invite King Ethelred back from Normandy. But they impose a very interesting condition on the king, and I think it's very telling. It shows us just what people were worried about. Ethelred can come back and rule them again, but only if he would govern them more justly than he did before. That's what the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle says. So there's obviously some very hard bargaining that's going on before Ethelred is allowed to come back. But come back he did. He faced the same faction fights as before, and the Danes are still there. They still control large sections of England. And finally, in 1016, the king dies. The English cause is now taken up by the king's oldest son, Edmund, the son of his first marriage, not the son of Edmund of Normandy. Edmund has a much more encouraging-sounding nickname than his father. He is known as Edmund Ironside, and he's a successful warrior. Edmund successfully defends London from a Danish attack. He beats Canute's army at the Battle of Assendon in Essex. Then, the two commanders, Edmund and Canute, seem to have made a kind of agreement to partition England and rule it justly. This was an admission that neither side was strong enough to defeat the other completely. Now, who knows how long such an agreement might have worked in practice. In the fall of 1016, Edmund Ironside died suddenly. Some people suspected foul play. So who's going to be king? Edmund has a very young son, just a baby, so that's not a good option. His half-brothers, the sons of King Athelred by his second marriage to Emma of Normandy, were also very young. The decision fell to the English Witan. I talked about the Witan in a previous lecture. This is the Council of Advisors to the King, and they have to figure out what to do in 1016. And they make a fairly obvious, realistic choice. They offer the throne to Canute. Now, Canute is the man on the spot. We'll see at several points over the coming lectures that when you have a disputed royal succession, it helps a lot to be the man on the spot. Canute is already in control of large sections of England. He seemed up to the job. After all, he had fought Edmund Ironside to a stalemate. And he does prove up to the job. Canute's reign as king is largely successful, and it's mostly remembered fondly by the English. Now, that may seem remarkable. He's a foreign conqueror, after all. But the change from Athelred seems to have been a welcome one. Several things, I think, went into making Canute a popular king. For one thing, he's good at public relations. He makes a very adroit move the year after he takes the throne. He marries King Athelred's widow, Emma. And this provides a kind of continuity. The English now have the same queen they had before. So there's a lot in it for Canute to marry Emma. But I think the more interesting question is, why does Emma marry Canute? I mean, this is the son of the man who drove her first husband into exile. He's substantially younger than she is, although maybe that's an incentive. Nobody knows. We have a biography of Emma written later in her life, but it doesn't go into the queen's motivations. That's not the sort of thing people wrote about in the 11th century. But I think we can be fairly safe in speculating that life as a widow isn't nearly as exciting as life as a queen. Emma seems to have been a fairly ambitious person. She doubtless wanted to be back at the center of things. And she does do her dynastic duty by Canute also. She bears Canute a son named Harthacnut and a daughter who dies relatively young. Canute had a rather colorful private life, though, because Emma is not the only lady in his life. He had been involved, since at least the time he came to the throne, with a noble Englishwoman named Alfgifu of Northampton. Now, whether they're ever married in a formal sense isn't clear. In Scandinavia in the 11th century, they're not that fussy about that sort of thing. Now, after Canute marries Emma, he does not by any means put off Alfgifu. There are, practically speaking, two queens in England, and each has patronage networks, and each has children to promote. Alfgifu had a couple of sons. We think, it's not entirely clear, there were lots of nasty rumors at the time about the parentage of her sons. It may be, though, that the situation got too tricky even for Canute to handle because in 1030, Canute sends Alfgifu off to Norway with her older son, Swain, to help rule the lands that he controlled there. Still, for over a decade, both of these women, Alfgifu and Emma, are at the center of English politics. It's a unique and very intriguing episode in English history. There have been many powerful royal mistresses since then, but never anything quite like this. But despite having a very colorful private life, Canute is a committed Christian on 11th century terms, and he certainly seems to have seen the public relations value of being seen to be a good Christian. He and Emma together patronize a lot of powerful churches in England. The memory of this patronage is preserved in the chronicles of these monasteries. There's a wonderful example from the Chronicle of Ely in Cambridgeshire. Ely is in the fen country of eastern England, and at that time, it was basically an island surrounded by marshes and streams. The best way to get there was by boat. But Knut thought it was worth going to see it, so he and Emma came one year to celebrate the Feast of Candlemas on February 2nd. Now, as their boat is approaching the church, the king hears the beautiful sound of the monks singing. The music is drifting down from the church to his boat. And he's so moved that he composes a little song in English, and it starts out, "The monks in Ely sweetly sang." And it goes on to say that his men should row closer to shore so that he can hear the music of the monks more clearly. The Ely chronicler, who's writing over a century later, he says that the song is still sung in Ely. So that's a charming story. Whether Knut wrote the song himself or not isn't really important. What matters is he's remembered as someone who was devoted to the church, and that counts for a lot. He also made a very public and very splendid pilgrimage to Rome in 1027. He timed his pilgrimage so that he could be present at the coronation of the German emperor. This is a way of enhancing his status with the Pope and with all of the important rulers of Europe. So Knut is a very astute politician. He also did a lot of things right on the political front at home. Even though he's a Dane, he's a conqueror, he's careful to work as much as possible within the existing English political framework. He doesn't change the system of local government very much at all. He pretty much leaves it alone. It's not broke, I'm not going to fix it. And this certainly helps in conciliating public opinion. Okay. He also doesn't shut out the English from royal patronage, and this may have been the most important policy of all. It's true he could be ruthless. It was clear, for example, that factionalism had been behind most of the troubles of Æthelred's reign. Knut is not going to have that same dynamic repeated under his rule. So in the first few years of his reign, he really quite ruthlessly purges his court of troublesome elements. And by that I mean that he just basically had people murdered. It was brutal, but it was effective. And the people who were loyal to Knut stayed loyal. And in fact, he accomplished a pretty remarkable feat. He managed to create a fairly united Anglo-Danish aristocracy. He fostered marriages between Englishmen and Danes, and a lot of those marriages worked out very well. The one that would have the most important long-term implications was the marriage between an English nobleman named Godwin and a Danish noblewoman named Githa, who was related by marriage to Knut himself. And this marriage would produce Harold Godwinson, the last Anglo-Saxon king of England. More about him in the next lecture. I mentioned Godwin here not just because of his marriage, though. He's also important because he's an example of one of the two important things about English government that Knut did change. Up until this point, the most important administrative unit in England was the shire or county, and each shire was ruled by an ealdorman or increasingly by a sheriff. For example, Byrhtnoth, the English commander at the Battle of Maldon, he was ealdorman of Essex. There were thus potentially quite a few ealdormen at any one time because there were several dozen English counties. We saw in an earlier lecture sometimes several shires would be grouped together, but Knut decides to take this trend much further by appointing only a few commanders, each of whom would rule a large group of shires, and they would bear the Scandinavian title Earl. Now, Earl is later going to be a very important title within the English aristocracy, and it all comes from Knut's reign. Now, Knut put Godwin in charge as Earl of Wessex, and there were also earls of East Anglia, Mercia, and Northumbria. In effect, Knut is reconstituting the old Anglo-Saxon kingdoms, but now they're administrative units of a unified English state. This change is going to have important consequences after Knut's death, because what it means is there are going to be a small number of very powerful nobles who are going to compete for power. This is fine as long as a king as strong as Knut is in charge, but it might spell trouble if the king is weak. The other major change that Knut makes, though, is unambiguously positive. He creates a new royal bodyguard, composed of his best Scandinavian troops, and these men are known as the Housecarls. They're an elite fighting force, and they're always going to form the nucleus of the king's army. And in the future, they're going to prove to be the most reliable part of the English army by far. The last thing I want to say about Canute is that he is the star of one of the most famous royal anecdotes in English history. And one reason I like it so much is that it illustrates so perfectly what makes the job of a historian difficult and intriguing. The problem is that we've got the story in two versions, and they're contradictory. It's the story of Canute and the tides. Here's how the first version of the story goes. One day, when Canute is at the height of his power, he goes down to the seaside, and he orders his royal seat to be placed on the shore as the tide is coming in. Then he tells the tides that since he is king, they should obey him and not presume to come onto his land and wet his royal person. Of course, the tides don't listen, and the king gets splashed. He then leaps up and proclaims that earthly power is worthless. And ever afterwards, he refuses to wear his gold crown, but places it instead on the image of Jesus affixed to the cross. So, in this version of the story, you have an arrogant king who is humbled. He learns a lesson and gets his priorities straight. But there's another version of the story. In this version, Canute is being plagued by a bunch of obsequious yes-men at court who keep telling him how wonderful he is. So, to teach them a lesson, he takes them all down to the beach, tells the tides not to come in, and when they come in anyway, he turns to his courtiers and says, "Look, I'm just a man like you are." In this version of the story, Canute is humble all along. He knows how the world really works. It's his courtiers who are taught a lesson. Now, did either version of the story really happen? Both are recorded over a century after Canute's death. Each story is tailored to fit the larger theme of the respective works in which they occur. Clearly, I think what's happening is these two authors are taking a folk story about Canute and interpreting it in a way that's going to help them make a larger point. I think it's possible to say, though, that both versions reflect well on Canute in the end. Whether he starts out humble or only gets that way after he gets splashed by the tides, he's a king who has a realistic view of what kings can do, and he's remembered kindly on the whole. But Canute does fail at a very important task for a medieval king. He does not manage to produce a viable successor, despite having two queens. He has three sons, we think, two by Aelfgifu of Northampton, one by Emma. The older of the two sons of Aelfgifu, Sweyn, is in Norway at the time of Canute's death and not in a position to come to England. He's in the process of being driven out of Norway. At any rate, he dies in Denmark just a few months after his father. Harthacnut, the son by Emma of Normandy, is ruling as regent in Denmark, because Canute is still, of course, king of Denmark as well as king of England. Harthacnut can't leave Denmark because Denmark is about to be invaded, and Harthacnut has to stay and defend Denmark. So Canute is succeeded by his second son, by Aelfgifu of Northampton, Harald Harefoot, and that's hair like rabbit. Presumably he's either a fast runner or he has very big feet. He only lasts 5 years, and then Harthacnut comes back from Denmark, rules for 2 years, and when he dies in 1042, that's the end of the Danish line in England. The second Viking conquest of England comes to a close with a dynastic whimper. Next time, we'll see what happens when the line of Canute runs out.
Lecture 11, The Norman Conquest.
Welcome back. In our last lecture, we saw England fall to Danish invaders, but we also saw that the line of Danish kings ended abruptly in 1042. In this lecture, we'll see England fall to invasion again, but the consequences are going to be far more lasting. We'll pick up our narrative with the reign of the last two Anglo-Saxon kings, Edward the Confessor and Harold Godwinson. And then we're going to spend the bulk of the lecture looking at the Norman conquest. We'll look at the succession crisis that came about when Edward the Confessor died without heirs early in 1066, and will follow the main claimants to the throne as they try to establish power in England. We'll see that it took a combination of luck and planning and sheer determination to win the English kingdom. In the last lecture, we talked about the reign of King Canute and of his two sons, neither of whom could live up to their father, even remotely. Both died childless. The second of these, Hartha Canute, died in 1042, leaving the throne to his half-brother Edward. Now, Hartha Canute had been the son of Canute and Emma of Normandy. Edward was also the son of Emma of Normandy, but his father was Emma's first husband, Athelred Unrad, the Unready. Unfortunately, Edward was not a whole lot readier to rule than his father had been, though he was considerably more religious, and that's how he got his nickname, Edward the Confessor. He also had a rather unpromising upbringing for a king of England. Edward had been driven into exile as a young child during the Danish invasions, and so he spent 3 decades at the Norman court with his mother's relatives. So he's a ward of the Norman dukes. He had very little contact with England for about 30 years. Now, there's some evidence that the Dukes of Normandy saw Edward as the legitimate claimant to the English throne throughout the period of Danish rule in England. And during the reign of Harold Harefoot, in fact, the Normans probably backed an expedition to England led by Edward's younger brother Alfred. And this was meant to sort of test the waters to see if there was any support in England for the legitimate English line, maybe to prepare for Edward himself to come later. But the expedition ended in disaster. Alfred was captured by agents of King Harold Harefoot. He was taken to Ely in eastern England and blinded. And he died of this treatment shortly afterwards. And that was not a very encouraging sign for the legitimate English dynasty. But things changed when Hartha Canute came to the throne in 1040. In 1041, Hartha Canute seems to have asked his half-brother Edward to come over to England from Normandy to rule as a sort of associate king. So Edward at this point has spent 3 decades as an exile, but now he's coming back to England. So when Hartha Canute died in 1042, Edward was there on the spot to take over. But Edward hadn't been around in England very long. He hadn't had time to build up a network of supporters. So he pretty much had to accept the existing noble power structures. And as a result, Edward's reign is dominated by a very difficult relationship with a powerful family known as the Godwinsons, headed up by Earl Godwin of Wessex. The Godwinsons are a noble English family. They've married into the Danish aristocracy, and this, as we saw last time, was their ticket to rise to power under Canute. As we also saw, Canute created a number of earls, great nobles who are entrusted with large sections of England to rule under royal supervision, and Earl Godwin is one of these powerful earls. Godwin is a very able courtier. He manages to survive various changes of regime, not so much because of his military abilities, he's not a particularly good soldier, but he's thought to be a very good politician. And one source has an interesting thing to say about him. It says that he knew when to talk and when to hold his tongue. So Edward the Confessor essentially inherits Godwin when he comes to the throne. Godwin is a power to be reckoned with and can't be shunted aside. Now, Edward might have had a very good reason to want to shunt Godwin aside. Godwin seems to have been directly involved in the murder of Edward's brother Alfred. He may have coordinated the whole thing at the orders of King Harold. And it goes to show how dominant Godwin is that King Edward does not feel able to get rid of him when he comes to the throne in 1042. And Godwin has a large family that needs to be provided for. He has at least 4 sons and several daughters, and so he induces King Edward to give the earldom of East Anglia to his very talented son, Harold. Harold also has a younger brother named Tostig, who's also quite gifted, but a little volatile, as we'll see. There are other brothers as well. They mostly tend to act as supporters to Harold and Tostig. And together, the Godwinson family directly control more than half of England. Godwin also provides for his daughter Edith rather spectacularly. He marries her to the king. So Godwin is now the king's father-in-law, and doubtless he's hoping to become the grandfather of the future king of England. The trouble is that the marriage remains childless. No one knows why. There are later pious legends associated with Edward the Confessor. They maintain that he remained chaste throughout his marriage to Edith. There's not a lot of reason to believe this. At a low point in relations between the king and his in-laws, he puts his wife Edith aside, and he's making efforts clearly to find a new wife. So he probably did at least try to beget an heir because he was actively trying to find a new woman to try this out with. At any rate, whatever the cause, the childlessness of this marriage between Edward and Edith is going to have tremendous consequences for English history because it provides the opening for William of Normandy to claim the English throne. But let's back up for a minute to look at why relations between the king and the Godwinsons fall apart. There had probably been tensions for many years. The amount of power that the Godwinsons had accumulated was simply too great for any king to tolerate, and his other noble supporters were probably actively conspiring against Godwin at court. Godwin's greatest enemy is the Norman-born Archbishop of Canterbury, Robert of Jumièges. Robert may have been promoting a plan at court to have William, Duke of Normandy, named the heir to the English throne, and this would obviously have been a serious threat to the power of the Godwinsons. Now, whatever the underlying causes of the tension, in 1051, matters come to a head, and the Godwinsons rebel. The rebellion is touched off by an incident at Dover. One of King Edward's continental in-laws, a man named Eustace of Boulogne, lands at Dover and demands provisions from the townspeople. They defy this demand, and they rough up Eustace's entourage. The king orders Godwin, who's in charge of Dover, to punish the townspeople for this affront by destroying their property. Godwin refuses to comply. He clearly expected that the other English nobles would back him, but there's no backing forthcoming. The king summons Godwin to appear for judgment, but the king refuses Godwin a safe conduct. That means Godwin has reason to fear that he might be seized and imprisoned, or worse. Godwin feels he has no option but to go into exile, so he and his family flee England. But it turns out Edward simply can't rule England without the Godwinsons. And by the next year, 1052, they're back in England, back in power. Perhaps it simply took them that long to gather the noble support they needed to put pressure on the king. The result of their return to power is there's something of a purge of the Norman influence at court. And the big casualty is a significant one. Robert of Jumièges, the Archbishop of Canterbury, is driven into exile. He's replaced by an English-born archbishop named Stigand. He's a rather questionable churchman. He's Bishop of Winchester at the same time as he's Archbishop of Canterbury. This is a definite no-no, according to canon law. At any rate, the power of the Godwinson family remains basically unchallenged after this triumphant return. Ironically, their biggest problem is to come from within. That's later on. In 1053, Godwin dies. Harold takes over as Earl of Wessex. 2 years later, his brother Tostig is named Earl of Northumbria. The previous Earl had died, leaving a son who was too young to rule. So once again, the Godwinsons are dominant. They control the opposite ends of England. But cracks appear in the relationship between the two brothers, between Harold and Tostig. In 1065, the Northumbrians rebel against Tostig. There is a sense in our sources that Tostig, a southerner, doesn't really understand the way the northerners do things. They don't get along. And Tostig is driven out of Northumbria, and Harold refuses to back him. Tostig ends up taking refuge in Flanders, and he's furious with his brother Harold, clearly determined to take revenge. So politics in England are in a very unsettled state. And then, in the fall of 1065, King Edward the Confessor falls ill. He knows his end is approaching, so he has time to arrange to die in Westminster Abbey. Westminster Abbey was a new church that he had built in the western part of London, and it's probably his most lasting legacy to English history. But his death in January of 1066 leaves no clear heir to the English throne. There were three main claimants, though, and I'll set out their claims to the throne in turn. First, there's the man who ultimately succeeds in becoming king, Harold Godwinson. He's the most powerful magnate in England, and he, again, is the man on the spot. The king's council, the Witan, chooses Harold within days of Edward's death, and there are two reasons why they choose Harold. First, he seems the best able to take up the burden. He's an experienced leader. And the second reason is, and it depends on which source you believe, the second reason is that the king, Edward the Confessor, seems to have designated Harold as his heir when he was on his deathbed. So Harold has proximity going for him. Harold is crowned king at Westminster Abbey by the Bishop of London. Normally, the Archbishop of Canterbury would have done this, but the Archbishop at this time is Stigand, and there are doubts about whether he's a totally legitimate Archbishop. Consecration is something you don't want to mess around with. You don't want there to be any reason why you want to question its validity. Now, who's the second claimant? The second claimant is Harald Hardrada, King of Norway. He claims the throne via his relationship to King Knut, who was also King of Norway for a time, as well as of Denmark and England. Now, the relationship between Harald Hardrada and Knut isn't especially close, but Harald Hardrada is a formidable warrior, and he wants to ride this force as far as he can. Now, incidentally, I'm sorry that everybody in this lecture seems to be named Harald. But anyway, Harald Hardrada has a long military career behind him. He is also probably hoping to take advantage of any lingering pro-Scandinavian sentiment that might be still alive in certain regions of England. He wants to do what the Danes had done earlier in the century, take advantage of that fifth column. Now we come to the third claimant, William, Duke of Normandy. And his claim is in many ways the most tenuous and also the most complicated. But before I explain why William thinks he has the right to be King of England, I want to say a little bit about his background and his personality. I think that will help us understand why William feels bold enough to embark on this very risky venture. He's going to attempt a seaborne invasion of England. Napoleon does not pull that off. Hitler doesn't pull that off. Where does William get the self-confidence to do such a thing? Well, William is still a young man when he contemplates invading England. He's only about 36 years old. But he has already experienced a lifetime of military campaigns and political intrigue. He's the illegitimate son of Duke Robert III of Normandy and a woman named Herleva. Herleva was probably the daughter of some sort of royal official in the Norman town of Falaise. The church at this period is starting to crack down on illegitimacy. So Duke Robert has to work hard to get his nobles to accept his son William as his heir, despite the fact that he is a bastard. And in fact, one of William's nicknames is William the Bastard, although I don't think that's the one you wanted to use to his face. Things got even worse for little William in 1035 because his father went off on a pilgrimage to Jerusalem and he died on the return journey. And 8-year-old William is left at the mercy of warring factions of Norman nobles. And William has to spend his whole childhood and young adulthood fending off various challenges to his rule. But William the Bastard is made of stern stuff, and he perseveres against his noble enemies, and he's able to consolidate ducal control of Normandy as never before. So, William has good reason to think he's capable of taking on a challenge as big as conquering England. He's already accomplished quite a lot. But does he have a right to do it? Does he have a right to the throne? William claims the throne on two grounds. One is his relationship to Edward the Confessor. Edward's mother, Emma, is also William's great aunt, so they are related by blood, although not terribly closely. Now, one would think that the relationship should have to flow through the male line for it to provide a claim to the English throne. I mean, William's not related to any English king. But in this period, notions of descent are still forming, so there's a ghost of a rationale for the claim via William's relationship to Emma. But the more potent of the two grounds for claiming the English throne is William's contention that Harold had promised to support William's claim. And he'd broken that promise. And by breaking the promise, Harold had perjured himself. Now, the story behind this claim is fascinating. William asserts that in 1064, Earl Harold had been traveling to Normandy when he was blown off course, and he landed in the county of Ponthieu, which is in France, just to the north of Normandy. And there he fell into the hands of the hostile Count of Ponthieu, who held him for ransom. Duke William arranged for Harold's release, and in exchange, he made Harold swear that Harold would back William's claim to the throne when the time came. Now, this is a culture that values oaths very highly, so to accuse Harold of breaking an oath is to hold him up to serious public criticism. The problem is, the sources of this story about Harold's oath are all Norman, and they're all potentially self-serving. Some historians believe the story, some don't. But at any rate, William seems to have felt that this story is going to give his effort to take the English throne legitimacy. And the reason he needs legitimacy is he wants papal backing. He sent churchmen from Normandy to Pope Alexander II, to try to get the Pope to bless the invasion as a means of bringing the English church into stricter compliance with papal policy. Pope Alexander found this argument that Harold had broken an oath very persuasive. He already didn't like Harold because of the Godwinson family's role in getting rid of Archbishop Robert of Jumièges and putting in Stigand. So the oath argument tips the Pope over the edge, and he does, in fact, approve of the invasion. And he even provides William with a special papal banner that he can fight under. So those are our three claimants, two Harolds and a William. Let's go back to Harold Godwinson, now on the throne as Harold II. Harold has a big problem, in addition to the fact that the Pope doesn't like him. The big problem is his own brother Tostig. You'll remember that the previous year, Tostig was driven into exile when his subjects in the Northumbrian earldom rebel against him. And Harold had rather ostentatiously refused to support his brother. And Tostig had gone off to lick his wounds in Flanders. Tostig then had to stand by and watch from across the English Channel while his brother seized the throne of England. Of course, this infuriates Tostig even more, and he determines to cause trouble for Harold. In May of 1066, Tostig crossed the Channel, and he tried to harry the southern coast of England, particularly the Isle of Wight. He was trying to drum up support for his cause. These efforts are largely unsuccessful, so Tostig then turns to an alliance with the King of Norway, Harald Hardrada, although they might have been acting together all along, we're not sure. At any rate, Tostig goes off to join Harald Hardrada in Norway to prepare to invade England. King Harold, in England, is certainly aware of this growing threat from Normandy. News travels fairly quickly. But he also knows that trouble is brewing in the south. By the summer of 1066, it's well known in Europe that Duke William of Normandy is planning to invade England. It's simply not possible to keep such a huge project a secret. Word undoubtedly filters back to England that hundreds of ships are being built in Normandy. And the most splendid of these is the gift of the Duke's beloved Duchess, Matilda. The best estimates that we have of the size of William's force are about 7,000 to 8,000 men. Maybe 1,000 to 2,000 are horsemen. Now, these soldiers come from Normandy itself, but also from Brittany and Flanders. These are two areas to which the Norman dukes have very close family ties. There are also men from other parts of France. So it's a fairly mixed group, not just Normans. And the important point is that this is a huge army for this period. So King Harold is more afraid of William with his huge army than he was of Harald Hardrada. So the king assembles his forces on the southern coast of England to meet the invasion. However, contrary winds bottled up William's fleet across the channel for week after frustrating week. And ultimately, Harold has to let some of his soldiers go home because it's harvest time. Harold is thus forced to rely almost exclusively on his personal military retainers, the housecarls. Now, the good thing is these are by far his most effective fighters, but still, he's a little bit under strength in the field. Just after Harold dismisses some of his soldiers, he gets word that the King of Norway, together with his own brother Tostig, has invaded Yorkshire in the north of England. So King Harold is at the wrong end of the country. Now, the choice of Yorkshire is doubtless no accident. As we saw, York was the center of a Viking kingdom in the 10th century. There was still substantial sympathy in that part of England for the Scandinavian cause. And in fact, Harald Hardrada and Tostig did score a significant success right away. The northern Firth, under Earls Edwin and Morcar, tried to meet the invading force at Fulford on September 20th, but they were soundly defeated. And this victory has to have been especially satisfying for Tostig, because Edwin and Morcar were his personal enemies. Morcar had, in fact, replaced Tostig as Earl of Northumbria in 1065, so there's a personal grudge at stake in the Battle of Fulford. Both Edwin and Morcar, though, survived the battle. The invasion in Yorkshire is a genuine emergency, and King Harold races north to meet the threat, covering a tremendous amount of ground in very short order. And on September 25th, just 5 days after the Battle of Fulford, King Harold faces the combined forces of Harald Hardrada and Tostig at Stamford Bridge. He defeats them decisively, and both the King of Norway and Tostig are killed in the battle. So one of the serious threats facing King Harold has been dealt with. But 2 days later, the winds in the English Channel shifted. This favorable change in the winds has led one historian to quip that William should be called not William the Bastard, but William the Lucky Bastard. Now, on September 28th, Duke William's fleet arrives off the Sussex coast in the southeast of England at Pevensey, and they occupy the port of Hastings. They immediately build a makeshift castle. It's just a big mound of earth, really, with a wooden tower on top. King Harold hears of these events and immediately rushes south again to confront William. This action of Harold's has been very controversial among modern historians. Some think he should have waited to gather his forces together. Others argue that Harold's forces were large enough to face William, but his real strategic error is risking a battle with the Normans at all. They should have simply hemmed them in on the coast until they ran out of supplies. That would have been a standard thing to do in this period. I'm not sure we can solve the question of whether Harold is wise or foolish to fight William at Hastings. We know, of course, what he didn't. We know he's going to lose. But he had just staked everything at Stamford Bridge and won. So from his perspective, he's simply expecting to repeat his recent success. Now, on Saturday, October 14th, 1066, the Battle of Hastings decides the future course of English history. Recent trends in historical writing have tended to play down the significance of the Norman conquest. Historians have pointed out that many things stay the same in England despite the arrival of the new regime. They emphasize continuity over change. I have a lot of sympathy with this point of view. It is a good correction to an earlier belief that the conquest is a cataclysm that destroys English society and makes it something totally different. That's an exaggeration. Nevertheless, there's no doubt that the consequences of the Battle of Hastings are momentous. English history would simply look entirely different without it. We'll spend considerable time on this in the lectures to come. But for now, let's follow the English and Norman armies into battle. As I said, Harold had marched south and had gathered some of his supporters a few miles north of Hastings on a ridge, where he drew up the classic Anglo-Saxon defensive formation, a shield wall. This is undoubtedly a sound strategy in the abstract. A shield wall on an elevated position is notoriously hard to break. All Harold really has to do is hold the shield wall in the face of Norman attack, and he's going to win simply by not losing. And the battle turns out to be a very close-run thing indeed. Duke William's task is much more challenging. He has to break the shield wall, and in order to do this, he draws up his forces in the classic three battles or divisions. He himself commands the center. He puts the Breton troops under their Count Alan on the left flank, and on the right there are soldiers from among his other French allies. Now, these soldiers were all foot soldiers. William is not sending in his cavalry right away. He's keeping them in reserve, because it's not all that effective, usually, to have cavalry charge uphill. William wants to break the shield wall first before sending in the cavalry. But unfortunately, the infantry make very little headway against the English. Apparently, the English are raining down missiles of various sorts on the attacking Normans, though they don't seem to have had any archers. They're throwing spears and things like that. The Normans, on the other hand, are having trouble bringing their archers to bear. They're having trouble getting the angle right. Either the arrows would hit the English shield wall, or they'd shoot right over the English army and land behind them, or the English would manage to hold their shields at exactly the right angle to repel the falling arrows. So William decides he has to send in the cavalry after all. At first, the horsemen have no more success than the foot soldiers had had. The English shield wall stubbornly held. And it must be said, the English housecarls are a formidable obstacle. They fight with two-handed axes. They're more than capable simply of cutting off a horse's head. Now, when faced with this sort of treatment, it's perhaps not surprising that the Norman cavalry ends up retreating. And at this moment, the battle takes a dramatic turn. The cry goes out among the Norman soldiers that Duke William has been killed. Now, this would have been a disaster for the Norman forces. The fate of armies whose leaders die on the field is almost always dire. Usually, discipline collapses. So William has to take swift action. He rides out in front of his army, across the ranks with his helmet lifted to show his face, shouting defiance. And this is enough to stem the rout. At the same time, the English get a bit ahead of themselves. The English right pursues the fleeing Norman left. But once they had run downhill, they found themselves in disorder. They were vulnerable to a Norman counterattack. Many were surrounded and cut down by the Norman cavalry. And this incident seems to have given Duke William, this is a man who can think on his feet, it gives Duke William a brilliant idea. If a real retreat by the Normans, in fact, had turned out so well, what about a feigned retreat? And according to several Norman accounts of the battle, William has his forces perform the same maneuver deliberately twice more, this time drawing the English down to lower ground, out of the protection of the shield wall. And they can be, of course, more easily attacked that way. This method results in the weakening of the shield wall. There are simply not enough soldiers left at the top of the hill to maintain the line. It might seem odd that the English fell for this, but I think it's important that we realize medieval warfare just isn't very much the same as modern warfare. People don't drill. There's no elaborate chain of command. And so there's nobody really able to get the English soldiers to stay up in the shield wall where they're going to make more of a difference. Orders were given on the battlefield, certainly, but that doesn't mean they're going to be obeyed. Only very charismatic leaders like William had a good chance of being followed into very obviously dangerous situations. And even then, the confusion of a medieval battlefield meant that soldiers often simply did what the man next to them was doing. It was extremely common for armies to break and run if the shield wall failed. So the English soldiers at Hastings are not being uniquely incompetent when they fall for William's maneuver. The battle finally ended, though, in a kind of reversal of what the Normans had feared at the beginning. King Harold was, in fact, killed, and his death precipitated the final rout, just as William had worried would be the case if he were thought to be dead. Remember the difficulties that the Normans were having early in the battle, bringing their archers to bear? They seem to have figured things out later on, because Harold was apparently struck by an arrow in the eye. We can't be sure about this. As with much else about the battle, there are different accounts. But that's what people very quickly came to believe about Harold's death, because two generations after the battle, the story was told that William had specifically told his archers to aim their arrows high so that they would fall on the English soldiers from above. This story sounds as if it was concocted to give William credit for a brilliant tactical maneuver when we're probably just talking about a lucky accident. Lucky for the Normans, that is. William had eliminated his rival, and he's now poised to take the throne of England. He spends the next 2 months maneuvering in a wide circle to the north and west from Hastings on his way to London, where, on Christmas Day, 1066, he is crowned king in Westminster Abbey, less than a year after the consecration of his unfortunate predecessor. Along the way, he gathers support from various English magnates who are eager to make their peace with a new regime. In the next lecture, we'll follow William as he uses all of his administrative talent and determination to make Norman rule in England a reality.
Lecture 12, The Reign of William the Conqueror.
Welcome back. In our last lecture, we looked at the Norman conquest, and we saw William, Duke of Normandy, win the Battle of Hastings in October of 1066 and get himself crowned king at Westminster Abbey on Christmas Day. I want to back up a bit now and say a little bit more about the process that got William from Hastings to Westminster Abbey, and then I want to talk about how he went about consolidating his rule over England. It's not a smooth process. There are some significant bumps along the way, and these bumps may have had a big impact in determining how William was going to develop his policies towards the English. He started out thinking he's going to be able to just step in as king and work with the existing system. It turned out he was going to need to exert a lot more pressure than he thought to make the English submit to the new regime. He had to spend the first 5 years of his reign responding to revolts by Englishmen. And later, he also had some revolts to deal with by Norman followers as well. But he was ultimately successful. How did he do it? He made use of some existing English administrative structures, things we've already talked about. He also created new power bases for his supporters. He tried to bind his supporters very strongly to him by means of a special oath, and he tried to make the most effective possible use of the resources he had in England. And all of these factors together made William just as successful as King of England as he had been as Duke of Normandy. So let's follow William from the battlefield at Hastings on his way to London to get crowned. Of course, London is the big prize. As soon as the Battle of Hastings had been won, William set his sights on London, but he didn't want to head straight for the capital. He wanted to prepare the ground first in a couple of ways. One of these was military, because a frontal assault on London was a very bad idea. It was a walled city. It could have held out for a long time. So William made a big arc to the northwest of London, harrying and burning as he went along. And this process was meant to convince the English that William meant business. And it also isolated London from reinforcements. If you've burned a lot of the supplies in the area immediately around a city, it's hard for that city to hang on in a siege. So that was the military approach. But William was also a very smart politician. At the same time as he was out taking care of the military side of the operation, he's also putting out feelers to prominent English leaders, noblemen and churchmen, to see if they might be willing to come over to his side. And one by one, the English leaders did this, and I think they began to see a sort of inevitability about William's conquest. One of the leaders to submit is Archbishop Stigand. This is that questionable Archbishop of Canterbury that we've talked about before. Also, the Earls of Mercia and Northumbria, Edwin and Morcar, they came and submitted to William. These were actually the brothers who had lost the battle against Harold Hardrada 5 days before King Harold beat Harold Hardrada at Stamford Bridge. They had fled that battle. But here they are again, accepting William as king. Now, one of the most interesting people to submit to William is actually a man who has a much better claim to the throne, at least by genealogical reckoning, than anybody else in England. And I'm talking about a man named Edgar Atheling. Now, the word Atheling just means prince or possible successor to the throne. And he's called prince because he is the grandson of Edmund Ironside. and thus he's the great-grandson of Æthelred the Unready by his first marriage. Now, Edgar's story is fascinating because he strikes me as one of the most amazing survivors in English history. Every time you think there's no way Edgar can get out of this mess, he does. Let's back up for a second to the time of the Danish invasions in the early 11th century. Edmund Ironside dies in 1016, and he leaves Knut in control of England. But Edmund Ironside had had a young family, including a son named Edward. This young family was spirited away into exile on the continent. They actually wound up in Hungary, of all places. Little Prince Edward grew to manhood, got married, and produced three children, a boy, Edgar, and two girls, Margaret and Christina. Then, in the 1050s, he's living happily in Hungary all this time, all of a sudden, a messenger arrives from the court of Edward the Confessor in England, asking Edward, the son of Edmund Ironside, to come to England. So, he came. The theory is that Edward the Confessor is getting old in the 1050s, and he knows he's not going to have any children, so he's trying to find somebody who can represent the legitimate line of the Wessex dynasty, and that would be Edward from Hungary. But when Edward arrives in England, the king refuses to see him, and nobody knows why. Maybe he changed his mind about naming Edward as his heir. We just don't know. But shortly after arriving in England, Edward died, leaving his son and two daughters behind. One daughter, Christina, became a nun. The other daughter, Margaret, later on married the King of Scotland. The son, Edgar, is treated with honor. He's given the epithet Atheling, which carries with it the implication that he's worthy of succeeding to the throne. But in January of 1066, when Edward the Confessor dies, Edgar is not chosen. Maybe he's too inconsequential. He's too young. He's just a teenager. But nobody thinks of him as a serious candidate for the throne. But in the fall of 1066, after William the Conqueror wins the Battle of Hastings, the English Witan, the English Council of Advisors, at least the ones who are still alive after Hastings, they offer the throne to Edgar Atheling, because otherwise they're going to be ruled by this foreign conqueror, and maybe Edgar Atheling is a better bet. But when it was clear that William had been able to cut off support for London, Edgar submitted to William. Edgar doesn't want to fight for his right to the throne. He's mostly interested in surviving. So a few days before Christmas in 1066, William of Normandy can enter the English capital. He is crowned in Westminster Abbey on Christmas Day. But the coronation doesn't go off perfectly. Because the audience has in it both English speakers and French speakers, William is proclaimed king in both English and French. And the people present take up the shout, and it's apparently so loud that the king's troops who are outside the abbey, they mistake the noise for a riot, and they take action. They set fire to several houses near the abbey. And this is obviously not exactly the way the day was planned to go. But still, William is king. And just like Harold Godwinson, William avoids being consecrated by Stigand. He gets the Archbishop of York to do it instead, because you can't be too careful about the validity of a consecration. So now, William is well and truly king of England. What's his first priority going to be? Of course, he needs to shore up the military situation even further. So one of the very first steps he takes is to begin the construction of a great fortress in London, and this becomes known as the Tower of London. And if you go to the tower today, you can still see the original tower that William had built. Now, of course, since then, the tower complex has grown tremendously. Lots of new towers were built, walls and other buildings. But already, with this first tower, the new ruler of England is making a statement, because castles were very, very important to establishing control of the countryside in this period. If you have control of a castle, even of a very basic one, just one tower on a hill, you can control the countryside, and people have calculated this, you can control the countryside around you for about a 10-mile radius. And William built many other such castles throughout England within a few short years, and they helped him achieve control over England and maintain it. William also held talks with leading Englishmen. He basically promised that he was going to rule England in the manner it was accustomed to. He didn't have any big plans to change things. And one reason he's saying this is that he's basing his right to rule England on being the person that